Blog Talk Radio.
Well, that never happened to the other fella. James Bostic here, Conservative Perspective on Patriot Nation Radio Endeavor here at Blog Talk Radio. Good to be with you. We do it live twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We also have a recorded version of the program that goes out Sundays, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Mojo 50 Radio Network. Mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, you should be, because it is the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio. All right, we're going to do something here which I don't normally do, and that is try and upload a clip while I'm actually already doing something, but we're going to do it. We're going to do it. And we got a couple clips that we're going to listen to tonight. One of them goes back in time a little bit. It's a 60 Minutes segment from a long, long time ago that you will, well, those of you who are old enough will remember it. But before we do that, in the last couple of years, with the thanks to the pandemic, it has provided ample opportunities for those of an authoritarian or a tyrannical mindset to capitalize on those sorts of things. And we've seen it, you know, California, Los Angeles, you got to have those papers, baby. You got to have those jab papers. Michigan. At one time in Michigan during the pandemic, you weren't even allowed to buy potting soil. Now, why the hell you weren't allowed to work in a garden, I'll never know, but you weren't allowed to do it. And we see some encouraging things. Loudoun County, Virginia, you know, we saw parents deciding that they knew best, you know, what was important in their kids' education after all. And they're correct. They do. And little pockets of resistance here and there. I think they're spread out enough to where people can be encouraged and take heart from it. But most people, most good people, won't fight it. They won't fight it. Most people won't fight evil. How do I know this? Nazi Germany. Communist Russia. Communist China. Communist Cuba. Socialist Venezuela. Communist North Korea. Communist Vietnam. Dennis Prager has some good thoughts on that, and I've got it set up. Maybe I have it set up here. Not very long, a couple minutes, and then we're going to move into the big clip I want to play concerning some things that may or may not sound familiar. If you're old enough, yeah, they probably do. If you're not, let me just say this. Everything old is new again. Dennis Prager right now talking about why most people won't fight evil.
As long as I remember speaking, I have said this. People say that evil is dark. But that's not true. Evil is actually very bright. You can look at the dark, but you can't look at the very bright. Very few people stare at evil. They deny it. There's a very famous book called The Denial of Death, where in Ernest Becker, who wrote the book, speaks about the human desire to really deny that they'll die. But the truth is, everybody knows they'll die. What people really deny is evil. Because if you acknowledge evil, you have to fight it. And people are not brave. That's the human condition. And they don't want to fight it. They want to deny that it's really that bad. So I have seen this all of my life, especially with outside of Nazism, the great 20th century evil of communism. 100 million people, approximately, were killed by communist regimes, not in war. I'm not talking about deaths of soldiers. I'm talking about just innocent people, tortured, starved, burned, shot to death. That's the record. See, that's an example, though, of people in a sort of denial. You should be shocked and horrified at what I just said. 100 million people in one century? But it doesn't. Stalin, the Soviet tyrant, who, by the way, made North Korea possible, tragically. Stalin is truly evil. Anyway, Stalin, who killed about 20 to 40 million people of his own nation, Soviet Union, a combination of Russia and other countries that the Russian Empire owned, he said, it's a very famous statement, actually, one death is a tragedy, 1 million is a statistic. That's the state of people's understanding of evil. So when I said 100 million, people don't fall down and go, oh my God, it's too grandiose to even imagine. And remember, for every one of the 100 million, think of the ripple effect on family and friends and community. So we're talking about 1 billion people of staggering suffering that communism caused. And yet, when I grew up, anti-communism had a bad name. Yeah? Oh, he's an anti-communist zealot. What's wrong with that? I hope you were an anti-Nazi zealot. Why aren't you an anti-communist zealot?
Good question. And, you know, there's another clip that ties in with this. And I disagree. Well, no, let me change that. I do agree. I agree with what he says to a certain point. When he says that people don't want to fight evil, I probably Probably. But at the same time, I think of the instances in history when evil has been forced upon people. And they had no choice but to fight. World War II is a great example of that. Evil was forced on us at Pearl Harbor. Evil was forced on Europe through what the Nazis were doing to the Jews, to the gypsies, to the elderly, to the mentally infirm, to any of those they deemed unfit. And when I say unfit, I mean unfit to live. Because ultimately, the plan of the Nazis was to eliminate all these people. Work them to death, shoot them to death, gas them to death, medical experiment them to death. Use them up. Use them and treat them like a disposable commodity. And they did, to great effect. That's evil. That is straight up evil. Communism, evil, evil, evil. I played a clip the other night, I think it was Tuesday night. Another short one, and we'll get into that. George W. Bush, Nazi. Richard Nixon, Nazi. Ronald Reagan, Nazi. George H.W. Bush, Nazi, 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 Nazi. Donald Trump, Nazi. Which kind of is it a conflict? Because, you know, they call him a Nazi, but at the same time, they paint him as cozying up to the Russians. Let me tell you something, people. Russians and Germans, the Nazis and the communists, hated each other. They hate each other to this day. Both sides dream about smearing the other side's ever-living guts across the continent on the treads of their tanks. You don't have to look any further than the Winter War. You don't have to look any further than how the Russians and the Germans treated each other throughout Russia. And then towards the end of the war, as the Russians moved in to take Berlin. But still, communism kills 100 million people, minimum, in the last century. But if you're doing something that the left doesn't like, by damn, you're a Nazi. I like to think of it as projection. And projection, fundamentally, most of you armchair psychologists know, it is those things that you do, those bad things that you do, those flaws, those terrible qualities of dishonesty, of thievery, of deceit, of hatred, of bigotry. You take those things, those flaws, those foibles, and you accuse your ideological opponent of doing them. And I think there's a lot of projection that emanates from this Marxist cultural leftist, progressive, communist, pinko fag business. I mean, you know, it's all the same. It is all collectivism. It's communism by any other name. It's a horrible ideology. It is a vicious, brutal ideology. It is a thoughtless, careless, compassionless, unfeeling ideology, just as Nazism was. But why isn't communism hated like Nazism? And Dennis Prager has an answer for that one, too. Check it out.
When people describe particularly evil individuals or regimes, why is it that they use the terms Nazi or fascist, but almost never communist? Given the unparalleled amount of human suffering communists have caused, why is communist so much less a term of revulsion than Nazi? Communists killed 70 million people in China, more than 20 million people in the Soviet Union, not including about 5 million Ukrainians, and almost one out of every three Cambodians. And communists enslaved entire nations in Russia, Vietnam, China, Eastern Europe, North Korea, Cuba, and much of Central Asia. They ruined the lives of well over a billion people. So why doesn't communism have the same terrible reputation as Nazism? Reason number one, there is, simply put, widespread ignorance of the communist record. Whereas both right and left loathe Nazism and teach its evil history, the left, and I'm talking about the left, not traditional liberals like Harry Truman or John F. Kennedy, has never loathed communism. And since the left dominates academia, almost no one teaches communism's evil history. Reason number two, the Nazis carried out the Holocaust. Nothing matches the Holocaust for pure evil. The rounding up of virtually every Jewish man, woman, child, and baby on the European continent and sending them to die is unprecedented and unparalleled. The communists killed far more people than the Nazis, but never matched the Holocaust in the systemization of genocide. The uniqueness of the Holocaust and the enormous attention rightly paid to it have helped ensure that Nazism has a worse name than communism. Reason number three, communism is based on nice sounding theories. Nazism isn't. It's based on heinous sounding theories. Intellectuals in general, including, of course, the intellectuals who write history, are seduced by words, so much so that they deem actions as less significant than words. For that reason, they haven't focused nearly as much attention on the horrific actions of communists as they have on the horrific actions of the Nazis. They dismiss the evils of communists as perversions of true communism, but they regard Nazi atrocities, correctly, as the logical and inevitable results of Nazism. Reason number four, Germans have thoroughly exposed the evils of Nazism, have taken responsibility for them, and have attempted to atone for them. Russians have not done anything similar regarding Lenin's or Stalin's horrors. To the contrary, Lenin, the father of Soviet communism, is still widely venerated in Russia. And as regards Stalin, as University of London Russian historian Donald Rayfield puts it, people still deny, by assertion or implication, Stalin's Holocaust, unquote. Even less so has China exposed the greatest mass murderer and enslaver of them all, Mao Zedong. Mao remains revered in China. Every Chinese currency note has his picture on it. Until Russia and China and Vietnam and Cuba and North Korea acknowledge the evils their countries committed under communism, communism's evils will remain less known than the evils of the German state under Hitler. Reason number five, communists murdered mostly their own people. The Nazis, on the other hand, killed very few fellow Germans. World opinion, that largely meaningless and amoral term, deems the murder of members of one's own group far less noteworthy than the murder of outsiders. That's why, for example, blacks killing millions of fellow blacks in Africa elicits almost no attention from world opinion. And reason number six, in the view of the left, the last good war was World War II, the war against German Nazism and Japanese fascism. The left does not regard wars against communist regimes as good wars. For example, the American war against Vietnamese communism is regarded as immoral, and the war against Korean communism and its Chinese communist backers is simply ignored. Until the left and all the institutions influenced by the left acknowledge how evil communism has been, we will continue to live in a morally confused world. In the meantime, all good people owe it to the victims of communism to learn what happened to them. Even worse than being murdered or enslaved is a world that doesn't even know that you were. I'm Dennis Prager. To keep our videos free, click here.
Thanks, Dennis. Not dead air. I'm just thinking about what to say. When I was a kid, growing up in the mid-late 60s, early 70s, the threat of, I want to say communist domination of the world, and that's, yeah, that's, you know, very, very James Bondian and Man from U.N.C.L.E. and all that. But in the 60s, and indeed even into the early mid-70s, that was serious business. The communist threat of, like I said, subjugation, domination, subversion, was very real. The Cold War was something that primarily clandestine. And, you know, the intelligence operatives moving in and out of the halls of power, in and out of fields of action. The diplomats, the intellects, vast, cool, and unsympathetic. They regarded this country and our way of life with envious eyes, and slowly and surely they drew their plans against us. And they did for many, many years. So as a boy, those threats were real. Nowadays, you talk about communism. People don't, you know, the kids don't understand what you mean. I'm in the school business. My daytime gig, which I haven't quit, and I'm not going to, in case you were going to remind me not to. They don't understand the real and present, the existential threat that communism. I don't think they understand the real and existential threat, short-lived though it was, that Nazism placed upon the free world. And I think one of the reasons that it's more fashionable to use Nazism as a pejorative and to accuse people of Nazi-like tendencies has to do with the fact that there are so many ultra-left-wing people in media, in academia, which I think should change the name to Macademia because most of them are nuts. And I know this is going to sound hypocritical because I come from a family of educators. My father taught at a junior college here in the Mountain State for close to 96, 98 years. My brother, my mom, you know, they're in the school business. They, too, for a time, taught at this little community college. But both of them made their careers in the public school system, as have myself. My brother taught, still teaches, 41 years. My brother's taught, well, this is the end of the road for him. He's going to hang it up, retire, and then be a long-term sub for himself and double dip into the system, and I'm so proud of him. He taught science. He teaches biology. My mother taught literature and English grammar. And I'll be damned if I know how it happened, but here I am. But back to the history thing, they don't understand that the serious threat that Nazism posed to the whole world. The whole world was embroiled in war. The whole world was fundamentally uncertain of how this was, the free world, rather, that is, was relatively uncertain of what was going to happen. How was this going to turn out? And by the way, next Tuesday, December 7th, 2021, I would like to invite you guys to tune in for my Pearl Harbor retrospective, 80th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And we're going to be looking back on that. But, and all the time this war is going on, and in the years before, communism is building up strength. It's building up, yeah, strength. It's a strength that was brought about by subjugation. It was brought about by conquest. It was brought about by torture, by assassination, by terror, by famine, by political show trials and purges of academia and the military. I mean, you know, they were heartless, just like what we see today. Critical race theory, once upon a time, was critical class theory. At the turn of the century, not this one, but the last one, critical race theory was known as critical class theory. And what it had to do with, as today, critical race theory tells all people of color that they are victims and oppressed, and they tell white people that we are innately, by our very, you know, evil nature, prejudiced, bigoted, racists. Even though that's not the case for either one, and there are so many examples to the contrary beyond this, but that's all that is. Hopefully here soon I can get Trevor back on. Trevor Loudon, America's foremost authority on communist infiltration in the halls of power and influence in this country, can tell us all about The Enemy Within and Reds in the White House, two of his books. You need to check them out. The Enemy Within, 700 pages. It's an exhaustive work of who's who in terms of communists and communist sympathizers in the government. There's a terrific video out about it too. You can catch them both today, all three of them at Amazon. But all these people in the left, the progressive cultural Marxist left, they're all communists too. That's why they don't call anybody communist. That's why you never hear the left talking a whole lot of trash about Xi Jinping and communist China and the concentration camps that the Uyghur Muslims are put into, the genocide authorized by Xi Jinping of the Muslim Uyghurs. It's being carried out now. You think our government's not aware of it? Of course they are. So they're not going to say anything about that because they're fellow travelers. They are allies. Think about it. When was the last time you heard American media in the last, we'll say the last 20 years? Okay, let's go back 20 years. Let's go back to the turn of this century. Through the Clinton administration, we'll go back a little bit, you know, the last 4 years of the Clinton admin, moving up into today's modern times. The only people talking about communism and the communist threat were folks like Limbaugh, like Sean Hannity, like Mike Savage. Center and center right people, your establishment media types, they weren't talking about communism or communist threat. They haven't been talking about how effectively China has been in gaining hegemony over the Pacific Rim. They're terraforming in the Pacific, basically setting up giant stationary aircraft carriers where they can conduct naval air operations throughout the Pacific, reining in any number of targets, including the West Coast. Not dead air, just trying to think where I'm going to go from here on this. So we have a generation or two, possibly three, if you want to go back into the leftist infiltration of academics from the late 1950s, excuse me, on up until today, where we have these indoctrination centers where kids are taught what to think, not how to think. And they're either unaware of just how dangerous and on how many different levels that danger presents itself as real and present to the American way of life. And that's not a cliche. That is not a cliche. And I'm trying to think of a way to set this up to prove my point. And I really... words fail me sometimes. However, that being said, I just happen to think this will explain it. This will explain it perfectly. Right here. It is better, man. I don't care what you say. There, right there. Glenn Frey, my favorite Eagle, by the way. There you go. And you know that monologue, I play it a lot. I'm not going to play it tonight and wear you out with it. But you know the one, that best, the best is yet to come, that I do by Donald Trump. And I've been, you know, I did it through the campaign. It's great. What Democrats say these things about this country. What Democrat says it's better in the USA? What Democrat extols the virtues of the American way of life? They have it painted as this, you know, this white bread, you know, this white Anglo-Saxon Protestant middle class suburban professional button down. But it's not. Okay, the American way of life is not that. They want to personify it as that so that they can give it an identity, so that they can freeze it, so that they can freeze it in space and in time. And then they can attack it. But that is not what the American way of life is. Take all those things, all right, all those trappings that you see, you know, when they stereotypify that, okay? A couple of kids going to a good school, family living in a good neighborhood, mom and dad both working, but, you know, they're good jobs. They have money for savings. They have money for vacation. They have money for decent Christmases. They have money set aside. Maybe not a lot, but enough to give them that survivability, enough to give them that buffer, that firewall that being in the middle class gives you. You want to live in a good neighborhood with good kids and good neighbors and good schools. So, you know, that your kids are out there playing with these guys and it's all good. If you are so inclined and you are of faith, you want to find some place where you can go to church with like-minded folks. None of this has anything to do with color. None of it. Wanting a decent job, paying a decent wage to provide a living and sustenance for your family is not an exclusively Caucasian thing. It never was. They want to paint it that way, as though it's something that white people, you know, we're hoarding it. We're misers. We're keeping it off ourselves. We don't want to give it out. And that's not true. That's not true. What conservatism's message is, really, truly, hey, man, you know what, for me, yeah, it was tough, but it was a lot tougher for a lot of other people, and they made it, and you know what, I made it, and you can too. Come on. What does the left tell you? You can't make it. It's all stacked against you, pal. You're never going to win. You're never going to be like those guys. Unless you stick with us. You stick with us. You got that thing you call a vote. We want that. You give us that vote. You put us in power. We'll give you everything you ever wanted. You're not going to get it from those guys over there. They don't want to get up off of. Look at them over there. Look how happy they are. Look how content they are. Look how miserable you are. It's their fault. Let us help you. You can't do it by yourself. You need us. That's what the left says. That's what the left says. But that American way of life, that transcends race. It simply does. Who doesn't want those things? Name the Korean guy or the Cuban guy or the white guy in Houston or the black guy in Atlanta that don't want the same thing. They want decent jobs. They want to take care of their families. They want to be left alone. It's universal. Everybody wants that. There are agents and forces in the government that try to tell you that, no, that's not the right way. That's, no, not everybody. You can't do that. It's unattainable. You might want it, but you can't do it. Not without us. And it's not true. It will be tough. You'll be miserable. You'll cry. There'll be times that you stop by the store on the way home and you pick up a bottle of bourbon and you spend the weekend in oblivion. You're going to hurt. You're going to skimp. You're going to look around and you're not going to know how it's going to happen from one day to the next. But then all that working, all that digging, all that scraping, it pays off. When? I don't know. Took a long time for me personally. I got like little payoffs, and then I would become complacent, lose my focus, lose my traction, lose my momentum, and I would have to start digging and scraping again. But the point is, everybody has to dig and scrape. Very few people get it handed to them. Very, very few. And you can't be, you know, pitiful and look at those people and say that you've been cheated when so many more who've had it so much worse have attained so much more greatness. I guess that's really all I got to say about that. Back to the, God, I'm turning into Cutler. Now, here's how we're going to tie this in to the pandemic. Here's how we tie the authoritarianism of communism and fascism and Nazism and central committees and collectivism. Here's how we turn it in with the pandemic, okay? They're trying to start something new. The Omicron variant. And I mean, one thing called the Oh My God variant. Oh my God, here we go again. I mean, I don't feel good. Oh my God. Here we go. And it's on. We're going to go back in time. Let me find it. There was a thing way back when, in the mid-70s, called the swine flu. Yeah. Swine flu. It was a big deal, man. It was a big deal. You guys remember the H1N1? How many of you guys remember H1N1? The what? Yeah. That was the one that was going to kill us all about 10 years ago. The avian flu. Well, this was a swine flu. This is from 60 Minutes, the television show 60 Minutes, with Chris Wallace's father, Mike Wallace, long time, love you, long time, liberal. But still, in this case, it's worthy of listening to. Just see how many things sound familiar.
Remember the swine flu scare of 1976? That was the year the U.S. government told us all that swine flu could turn out to be a killer that could spread across the nation. And Washington decided that every man, woman, and child in the nation should get a shot to prevent a nationwide outbreak, a pandemic. Well, 46 million of us obediently took the shot. And now 4,000 Americans are claiming damages from Uncle Sam amounting to $3.5 billion because of what happened when they took that shot. By far the greatest number of the claims, two-thirds of them, are for neurological damage or even death.
This virus was the cause of a pandemic in 1918 and 1919 that resulted in over 500,000 deaths in the United States, as well as 20 million deaths around the world.
See how easy it is to...
Thus, the U.S. government's publicity machine was cranked into action to urge all America to protect itself against the swine flu menace.
Influenza is serious business. During major flu epidemics, millions of people are sick and thousands die. Well, this year you can get protection. The vaccines are safe, easy to take, and they can protect you against flu. So roll up your sleeve. Protect yourself.
One of those who did roll up her sleeve was Judy Roberts. She was perfectly healthy, an active woman, when in November of 1976, she took her shot. 2 weeks later, she says, she began to feel a numbness starting up her legs.
By the following week, I was totally paralyzed.
So completely paralyzed, in fact, that they had to operate on her to enable her to breathe. And for 6 months, Judy Roberts was a quadriplegic. The diagnosis? A neurological disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome. This disease can even kill. Indeed, there are 300 claims now pending from the families of GBS victims who died, allegedly as a result of the swine flu shot.
Judy, why did you take the flu shot?
I'd never taken any other flu shots, but I felt like this was going to be a major epidemic. And the only way to prevent a major epidemic of a really deadly variety of flu was for everybody to be immunized.
As part of informing Americans about the swine flu threat, Dr. Censor's CDC also helped create the advertising to get the public to take the shot.
swine flu. Man, I'm too fast for that to catch me.
You'll want to be protected. Get a shot of protection. The swine flu shot.
Let me read to you from one of your own agency's memos planning the campaign to urge Americans to take the shot. The swine flu vaccine has been taken by many important persons, he wrote. Example, President Ford, Henry Kissinger, Elton John, Muhammad Ali, Mary Tyler Moore, Rudolph Nureyev, Walter Cronkite, Ralph Nader, Edward Kennedy, etc., etc. Did you talk to these people beforehand to find out if they planned to take the shot?
I did not know.
Did anybody?
I do not know.
Did you get permission to use their names in your campaign?
I do not know.
Mary, did you take a swine flu shot?
No, I did not.
Did you give them permission to use your name saying that you had or were going to?
Absolutely not. Never did.
Did you ask your own doctor about taking the swine flu shot?
Yes, and at the time he thought it might be a good idea. But I resisted it because I was leery of having the symptoms that sometimes go with that kind of inoculation.
So you didn't?
No, I didn't.
Have you spoken to your doctor since?
Yes.
And?
He's delighted that I didn't take that shot.
Dr. Michael Hatwick directed the surveillance team for the swine flu program at the CDC. His job was to find out what possible complications could arise from taking the shot and to report his findings to those in charge.
Did you know ahead of time, Dr. Hatwick, that there had been case reports of neurological disorders, neurological illness, apparently associated with the injection of influenza vaccine?
Absolutely.
You did?
Yes.
How'd you know that?
By review of the literature.
So you told your superiors, the men in charge of the swine flu immunization program, about the possibility of neurological disorders?
Absolutely.
What would you say if I told you that your superiors say that you never told them about the possibility of neurological complications?
That's nonsense. I can't believe that they would say that they did not know that there were neurological illnesses associated with influenza vaccination. That simply is not true. We did know that. I've said that Dr. Hatwick had never told me of his feelings on this subject.
And he's lying.
I guess you would have to make that assumption.
Then why does this report from your own agency, dated July 1976, list neurological complications as a possibility?
I think the consensus of the scientific community was that the evidence relating neurologic disorders to influenza immunization was such that they did not feel that this association was a real one.
You didn't feel it was necessary to tell the American people that information?
I think that over the years we have tried to inform the American people as fully as possible.
The vaccines are safe, easy to take, and they can protect you against flu.
I asked, told Judy to take the shot. She wasn't going to take it, and she never had had shots. And I'm mad with my government because they knew the facts. But they didn't release those facts because if they had released them, the people wouldn't have taken. And they can come out tomorrow and tell me there's going to be an epidemic, and they can drop off like flies to me. I will not take another shot that my government tells me to take.
Meantime, Judy Roberts and some 4,000 others like her are still waiting for their day in court.
This is the CBS Television Network.
What cigarette do you smoke? You'll be interested to know how the doctors of America answered that question. Tens of thousands of doctors. Doctors in all parts.
I think we'll skip the Camel commercial. The clip goes on a little bit longer, but I think that's as good a place to stop as anywhere. And I'm looking for the COVID summary. Okay, I think this is it. It's called VAERS. And that is the Vaccine Adverse Effect Registry, something other. Anyway, what they do here is they take a look at vaccines and if there are serious side effects or adverse effects in this case, then they report on.
Form your own decision. This is from the CDC. And what we're going to talk about is COVID-19 vaccines in all their various incarnations. And we're going to break it down like this. And we're going to compare all the existing COVID-19 vaccines as they are from December of last year, a year ago. So we've got, you know, three. You got the J&J, Moderna, Pfizer. There are others that have come on board and are coming out, but we're going to talk about this. From last year to right now. And we're going to compare these issues that I'm going to talk about against all other vaccines from 1990 to present, all other vaccines in the last 30 years. The number of adverse reactions to the COVID-19 vaccine, 856,919. Compared to all other vaccines in the last 30 years, 845,019. So COVID, round one. The number of life-threatening events based on the COVID-19 vaccines, 20,110. All other vaccines for the last 30 years, 13,800. The number of hospitalizations, COVID vaccines, 88,000, almost 89,000. All other vaccines the last 30 years, 80,000. 80,000 in the last 30 years. The number of permanent disabilities after vaccination, in the last year with COVID vaccines, 28,102. And I want you to try and just don't lock your mind on these numbers, but just kind of keep them in the ballpark to get an estimate, because what I'm going to tell you next is going to really freak you out. So 28,000 permanent disabilities from December 2020 to now. From 1990 to now, with all other vaccines in use, 19,929. Number of office visits in the last year based on COVID vaccines, 133,972. For the last 30 years with all other vaccines that we're comparing it to, 46,456. The number of emergency room or emergency department visits from December a year ago to today, 95,898. In 30 years of all other vaccines available in America, 211,090, so we'll give them that one. The number of birth defects after vaccination. In the last year, from COVID vaccines, 610 children born birth defects. In the last 30 years, since 1990, with all other vaccines available in the U.S., 153. What I'm going to say to you with the vaccine adverse effect registry survey, whatever the hell they call it, of all the this is like right at 1, maybe 2% of people go on to report these things. So if 28,112 is the number of permanent disabilities after vaccination, and that's only 1% of the population that felt like they needed to make a statement and report it, what does that mean? That means close to 300,000 people may have had this problem. If 18,078 is the number of deaths that were reported, and that's 1%, so you see what I mean? And again, you've got a government push, just like in 1976. You have a government push to implement this vaccine. Get everybody jabbed. The only problem is, and they can't explain it, in the areas of concentration where you have the highest ratios of vaccinated versus unvaccinated people, COVID is making a comeback. And it's not making a comeback amongst the unvaccinated people, or as I like to refer to myself, a pure blood. Because I haven't had the vaccine. I have been immunized through prior infection. I'm convinced of it. And if it wasn't when this thing started, then it was about a month ago. So now, based on that, based on my prior infection, where I have natural immunity, natural antibodies, not manufactured, not genetically altering substances rolling through me, I'm 27 times safer than people that have been vaccinated who don't have a natural immunity. Immunosupremacy. I just made that up today. I have immunosupremacy over many, many people. These masks are killing us. They're killing our kids. They're killing our old people. They're not needed. If you want to get rid of COVID, take care of yourself. Eat right. Take your vitamins. Operate in an environment of plenty of good ventilation and sunshine. Not dead air, I'm just sitting here thinking. And the thing of it is, there are people out there in the media, amongst the general population, that take this pointy-headed intellectual tyrant this bureaucratic narcissist. They still take him seriously. They still take him seriously. This is the guy that said, no mask. Okay, a mask. Well, if one mask is good, let's do two masks. Well, if you get vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask. Well, you're going to have to wear a mask if you're vaccinated. It just makes good sense. But if you get a booster, all that will be cool. You don't have to do that. And now they're saying boosters every... This guy has no clue what he's talking about. He's been seduced by the Klieg lights, by the celebrity, by the kowtowing and the adulation. And he's lied about everything. He's a sick dude, man. You've heard about the Beagle experiment. I'm not even going to get into it, but you can just go check it out. It's awful, terrible stuff. This guy's been promising a cure for AIDS since AIDS has been around. He failed at that. He was put in charge of that, and he failed miserably. He's been in charge of this. He fails miserably. Where are we at? We're at 8 o'clock. Let's take a little break and I can figure out what we're going to talk about from there. You are listening to A Conservative's Perspective here on Patriot Nation Radio Network. We will be back with more after this brief musical interlude.
United States dollar took another pounding on German, French, and British exchanges this morning, hitting the lowest point ever known in West Germany. It has declined there by 41% since 1971, and this Canadian thinks it's time to speak up for the Americans as the most generous and possibly the least appreciated people in all the world. As long as 60 years ago, when I first started to read newspapers, I read of floods on the Yellow River and the Yangtze. Well, who rushed in with men and money to help? The Americans did, that's who. They have helped control floods on the Nile, the Amazon, the Ganges, and the Niger. Today, the rich bottom land of the Mississippi is underwater, and no foreign land has sent a dollar to help. Germany, Japan, and to a lesser extent, Britain and Italy, were lifted out of the debris of war by the Americans who poured in billions of dollars and forgave other billions in debts. None of those countries is today paying even the interest on its remaining debts to the United States. When the franc was in danger of collapsing in 1956, it was the Americans who propped it up. And their reward was to be insulted and swindled on the streets of Paris. And I was there. I saw that. When distant cities are hit by earthquake, it's the United States that hurries in to help. Managua, Nicaragua is one of the most recent examples. So far this spring, 59 American communities have been flattened by tornadoes. Nobody has helped. The Marshall Plan, the Truman Policy, all pump billions upon billions of dollars into discouraged countries. And now newspapers in those countries are writing about the decadent, war-mongering Americans. Now, I'd like to see just one of those countries that is gloating over the erosion of the United States dollar build its own airplane. Come on now, you, let's hear it. Does any country in the world have a plane to equal a Boeing jumbo jet, the Lockheed TriStar, or the Douglas 10? If so, why don't they fly them? Why do all international lines except Russia fly American planes? Why does no other land on Earth even consider putting a man or a woman on the moon? You talk about Japanese technocracy and you get radios. You talk about German technocracy and you get automobiles. You talk about American technocracy and you find men on the moon, not once but several times, and safely home again. You talk about scandals and the Americans put theirs right in the store window for everybody to look at. Even the draft dodgers are not pursued and hounded. They're right here on our streets in Toronto. Most of them, unless they're breaking Canadian laws, are getting American dollars from Ma and Pa at home to spend up here. When the Americans get out of this bind, as they will, who could blame them if they said to hell with the rest of the world? Let somebody else buy the bonds. Let somebody else build or repair foreign dams or design foreign buildings that won't shake apart in earthquakes. When the railways of France and Germany and India were breaking down through age, it was the Americans who rebuilt them. When the Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central went broke, nobody loaned them an old caboose. Both of them are still broke. I can name to you 5,000 times when the Americans raced to the help of other people in trouble. Can you name to me even one time when someone else raced to the Americans in trouble? I don't think there was outside help even during the San Francisco earthquake. Our neighbors have faced it alone. And I'm one Canadian who is damn tired of hearing them kicked around. They'll come out of this thing with their flag high. And when they do, they're entitled to thumb their noses at the lands that are gloating over their present troubles. I hope Canada is not one of these. But there are many smug, self-righteous Canadians. And finally, the American Red Cross was told at its 48th annual meeting in New Orleans this morning that it was broke. This year's disaster, with the year less than half over, has taken it all, and nobody but nobody has helped.
Wow. You know, I'll be honest with you. And I got to share this with you. I have always been absolutely a a sucker for that kind of thing, for that kind of imagery, for that, you know, the music, the tapestry woven by the words. I've always been, from a very young age, a sucker for that kind of stuff. I love it. I hear that kind of thing, man, and I turn into John Wayne and Captain America and Mel Gibson from The Patriot all rolled up into one cap. And when I was a boy, and this is no joke, when I was a boy, I think it was sixth grade, that guy there, his name was Gordon Scott, and he was a Canadian news commentator, and he did that at a time when America was at a particularly low ebb. And it was, like I said, 1974, we had been embroiled in Watergate and that national scandal, and the Vietnam War was coming to an end, not favorably for the United States. There was a lot of social unrest and upheaval, and you heard the picture that Gordon painted there. Well, this thing was about 1974, so this would have been my sixth grade we didn't have graduation ceremonies in those days. We didn't graduate from sixth grade and then move up into junior high or anything like that. But it was a end of our elementary school career kind of event, and there was singing, and we did some songs, and other kids did some things. Well, I did that. yes, I did. I did that. I sent off somewhere for the transcript. And I read that thing, and I read that thing, and I read that thing, and I read that thing. And I I came out, gosh, I hadn't thought about that until I heard this thing. And it's been a long time since I heard it. I came out, and there's all these moms and dads and people in the audience for both sixth grade classes there at Lincoln Elementary School, Mr. Meadows, Ms. Wilkes. And like I said, there was all kinds of talent, and then they let me do that. And I wasn't like a show closer, but I was on towards the end. So, and I did. I came out and I read that. And I'm going to go ahead and say I brought down the house, but I really don't remember if I did or not. But I gave for a six-year-old, I gave a creditable reading of it, but it has always been that way with America, if you stop and think about it. Excuse me. Anytime there's been a period of national strife beyond the Revolution, which, you know, we got a lot of help from the French, but any time in this country when there's been great national division, national strife, or there's been a terrible calamity of some kind, be it natural or man-made, it's just America doing what America does. And again, tell me, the Democrat, the liberal, the leftist, the Marxist, commie bastard over there in the Democrat Party, any one of them, just pick one, who says those things about America? Who takes those decidedly very pro-America position on these issues? No Democrat does. What Democrat takes a pro-America position on illegal immigration? That's right. I'll be damned if I can think of one either. It doesn't have to be illegal immigration. It could be vaccine mandates. It could be critical race theory. It could be gay marriage. Whatever the issue, whatever the hot button, abortion, oh, God. Whatever the hot button issue of the day or, you know, du jour is for you, or whatever cause celebrity you might have, they're not going to say anything good about this country. They can't, because they've been so heavily invested in telling us all the things that are wrong with this country, all the reasons this country's bad. They're invested so heavily into that, they can never, ever, ever talk about how good this country is, how overwhelmingly good this country is. And ultimately, if we have a truly objective and fairly balanced set of scales, the good of this country vastly outweighs the bad. The beauty of this country vastly outweighs its ugliness. The great and bright and still, I think, very real promise of the American dream, of that opportunity, still exists, as opposed to the dull, uniform, soul-crushing mediocrity of government support. There is no cavalry. There's no Han Solo. There's no James T. Kirk coming in from the atmosphere in the Enterprise, photon torpedoes and phasers blazing to save us. We're going to have to be the cavalry. You're going to have to be Han Solo. You're going to have to be Captain America. I'm going to be Captain Kirk. That's already been established and settled in the story. But you get the point. You see what I'm saying? We can't rely on anyone else. That's why I say we're the cavalry. We're John Wayne. We're Captain Kirk. We're Friday and Gannon. I mean, we have to be the good guys. For heaven's sakes, look at the other side. And there have been a lot of things that we can take heart in. A couple of judges have upheld the stay on the Biden administration's vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. It's national. And the same thing for federal employees and contractors. That's a positive thing. Not dead air, just thinking about stuff. School shooting in Michigan yesterday, 15-year-old kid whose parents had just been called in for a meeting concerning his behavior, like maybe the day before, within hours of this thing happening, prior to this thing happening. He gets a pistol that his dad had bought, and he took it to school, and he shot the place up. And he killed some kids and wounded a bunch of other ones. He was arrested. He was charged with first-degree murder and terrorism. And that makes perfect sense to me. That makes perfect sense to me because that's exactly what that was. That was a terrorist act. Was it an Islamic terrorism? No, it wasn't Islamic terrorism. Was it domestic terrorism of a sort? Yes. It wasn't motivated by any ideology. At least I don't think so. A lot of times these are angry kids who have had issues for a long, long time, and they blow up, they crack psychologically, and maybe some of them started out okay, maybe some of them were bad seeds from the get-go. But whatever the reason, it's not necessarily politically motivated, although there are going to be people that make that argument. No, this is not ideological terrorism, but it's definitely psychological terrorism. It's terrorism nonetheless. I guarantee you, anybody that got shot or saw what happened or was present when this happened, they were damn terrorized. I promise you they were. So, yes, terrorism. Now, Waukesha. Let's move on to Waukesha. Darryl Brooks, Sunday after Kyle Rittenhouse's acquittal a week ago, at a Christmas parade. A man with a history of violence, domestic and otherwise, sympathies leaning towards Black Lives Matter and Antifa, big George Mayweather fan, intentionally, not accidentally, not fell asleep at the wheel because he was drunk or stoned, intentionally drove his SUV into a crowd. Killed about 5 or 6 people, injured 40 others. I think those people were probably terrorized as well. But Darryl Brooks isn't charged with terrorism. Darryl Brooks wasn't looked at as a domestic terrorist, regardless of his support for that communist, that Marxist ideology of Black Lives Matter, of the fascistic Antifa. I'm not really sure about the Antifa, but I know he was definitely pro-BLM. He was pro-Black Lives Matter. We don't even talk about that. Why? Is it easier to charge the 15-year-old kid with terrorism because he's a 15-year-old kid? He won't come out. I mean, what's the deal? What's the problem? To me, these are both terroristic acts. Terrorists have carried out these acts using trucks and vans. They've done it in France. They've done it in Europe. They've done it here in the United States. That's what this was an act of terrorism. Perhaps ideological terrorism in this case, because, like I said, because of his sympathies and leanings towards Black Lives Matter. One gets busted for murder and terror, and there are two. The only difference is the weapon of choice. The only difference is the weapon of choice. This guy picked that parade because he knew that it was, in his mind, a target-rich environment. Same reason that kid took the gun to school, because he knew there would be a lot of unarmed people there that he could shoot. This guy knew there would be a lot of unarmed people around there that he could run over. Absolutely criminal. But then again, look at every Democrat-controlled city in America. Look at them. They're smoldering ruins. Yesterday in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio, God, what a doofus-looking dude, Jesus, celebrated the first designated area for people to consume illegal drugs. You can go to this area, don't know where it is. You can go to this area. If you want to bang, go ahead. You want to snort cocaine, go ahead. You want to smoke a joint, go ahead. You want to do pills and drink, have at it. You want to smoke some rock, do it. You can go right here and do it, man. Nobody's going to say anything to you. Nobody's going to say anything to you. And then from there, once you get your coke on, once you get your thing going, you can go out and commit crimes. Because with cash bail reform, You'll be out. You'll be out in hours. They'll never be able to arrest you fast enough to keep you in jail long. Democrat cities. Not dead air, just thinking about it. is drawing to a close. It's December. Is this going to be the beginning of that long, cold winter? Or are we going to triumph? Are we going to prevail?
Can you hear me now? Now we're down to the end of the show anyway. Hopefully you can hear me here. Conservative Perspective heard on Patriot Nation Radio Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Sundays, 4 p.m. on the Mojo 50 Radio Network. That's all the time we got, folks. If you can hear me, God bless you. God bless America. We'll see you next week, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective.